This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, April 17th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. KUAF Night with the Naturals is April 24th, a week from tonight at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. KUAF ticket holders will be seated together. One lucky guest will throw out the first pitch if over 200 KUAF tickets are sold. A portion of ticket sales will benefit KUAF. KUAF tickets are only available at 927-4063 or click the banner at KUAF.com to email in an order.
KUAF is supported by the fully remodeled and expanded Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart, Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville and open daily until 9 p.m., that's including Sundays, 277-8493 or on Facebook, facebook.com/Walmart Museum for more information.
On this edition of Ozarks, Mexico's history is long and rich and often misunderstood. I'll talk with a historian who's written 11 books on the subject.
Plus, a conversation with a gubernatorial candidate who cites his business background as sufficient experience for higher office in the state as we continue a series leading up to the elections this November.
But first, the Arkansas Lottery Commission voted yesterday to pursue electronic monitor games as a way of boosting lagging sales. The decision came only a day after a legislative oversight committee voiced its disapproval for such a plan. Lottery Director Bishop Woolsey says lottery proceeds, which fund scholarships in the state, would be bolstered by the added electronic games.
You know, my hope was that once we get it up and going, once it's full steam, you know, you may be looking at $4 or $5 million a year in proceeds that are generated because of maybe a little less, maybe more. It's hard to tell at this point.
Commissioner Diane Lamberth says there are other games lottery officials are hoping to add to the state's lottery system.
They've talked about the Keno game, which is a very interesting game. It's just a four-minute Powerball. You buy a ticket from the ticket machine, and you watch it on a TV screen to see who wins, just like Powerball.
Lamberth was also the only commissioner to vote against implementing new electronic games. She said she did support electronic games and merely wanted more time to better inform the legislature of the lottery's plans. The Arkansas Scholarship Lottery began in 2009 after voters authorized lottery sales the previous year. The law does not grant lottery officials authority to implement electronic slot machines, but the commission says the games they are proposing will be different.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Arkansas and the Arkansas Public Law Center yesterday filed a lawsuit challenging the state's voter ID law. The act, passed in 2013, requires voters to show photo identification at the polls, a prerequisite that ACLU Executive Director Rita Sklar says puts more burden on the voter than Arkansas's Constitution permits.
This law is a solution to a non-existent problem. And it only creates more trouble for people who have been voting all their lives. It throws hurdles in front of them instead of, again, making it easier for them to participate in the democratic process.
Sklar says the law targets populations with poor access to resources.
It's easy to see that these kind of laws are targeted at disenfranchising a certain group of people. And it's people that some people don't want to vote. It's that simple. The poor, people of color, the elderly, people they don't think will vote for them. Why else make it harder for them when there is not a problem?
The suit names Secretary of State Mark Martin and the State Board of Election Commissioners as defendants. Sklar says the ACLU is seeking a preliminary injunction and hopes to strike down the law before it can affect the primary and general elections. Advocates of the law see it as a necessary requirement, saying it protects against voter fraud and that presenting a valid ID is not an undue burden.
Walmart is ramping up its financial service offerings. According to the City Wire, the retail giant is teaming up with Kansas-based Euronet to offer a new money transfer service, similar to services the retailer currently offers through MoneyGram. Euronet, with its worldwide presence, reported $370 million of revenue last year from money transfers, and financial services added about $4.8 billion to Walmart's top-line revenue last year. That deal is expected to close by June.
Walmart's CEO has made a sizable contribution to the University of Arkansas. Doug McMillan, a UA alumnus, and his wife Shelley are donating $1 million to establish the McMillan Family Endowed Excellence Fund, which will benefit the Sam Walton College of Business. According to the university, the fund will establish an endowment that will help fund a proposed School of Global Retail Operations and Innovation. The school would reportedly have an interdisciplinary scope and global focus to engage undergraduate and graduate students in retail learning and research. McMillan graduated from the College of Business in 1989, and this February, he took over as CEO of Walmart.
The new urban agriculture ordinance in Fayetteville goes into effect today. Previously, only four hens were allowed on any single-family residential property within the city. Under the new ordinance, up to 20 female chickens or ducks, depending on property size, are allowed on properties with single-family or educational zoning designations. The new ordinance also allows urban farmers to keep up to three goats and four beehives, again, depending on property size, and home produce agricultural products can also now be sold on site.
Also in Fayetteville, the city's Development Services Department will begin accepting applications today for food truck owners to operate in parallel public parking spaces and in city parks. The applications will be accepted through Wednesday, April 30th, and city staff will choose nine qualifying applications through a lottery drawing on May 1st. For more information on either of the new city ordinances taking effect today, visit accessfayetteville.org.
Not much luck last night for the Northwest Arkansas Naturals. They opened a four-game set in Tulsa and were shut out 7-0 by the Drillers, their 10th consecutive loss. Series continues tonight in Tulsa.
Forecast this evening calls for mostly cloudy skies with a 20% chance of showers. Overnight lows from 40 in Northwest Arkansas to 46 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Friday, sunny with highs in the mid-70s. Tomorrow evening, mostly clear with overnight lows from 46 to 50. This is Ozarks at Large. As he will do all year long, Roby Brock with our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas, is spending time with each of the major party candidates for higher office in the state of Arkansas. He has spent some time on the road with Mark Pryor, Tom Cotton, Asa Hutchinson, and Mike Ross. He recently sat down with Republican gubernatorial candidate Curtis Coleman. Coleman is a Tea Party conservative and is challenging Asa Hutchinson for the GOP nomination for governor. Roby caught up with Coleman on the campaign trail.
Curtis Coleman is running for Arkansas governor as a constitutional conservative. Coleman is a former Baptist minister and previously ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010. Following his Senate primary loss, Coleman started the Institute for Constitutional Policy and a syndicated political radio report. But it's his business background as former CEO for food safety company Safe Foods Corporation that he says makes him most qualified for office.
As part of your, I think, political philosophy, you are definitely against government intervention on a lot of different fronts in terms of regulation, in terms of government interference and barriers to businesses. Yet the business that you're primarily known for, Safe Foods Corporation, right, was started with research that came out of a government operation. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that there were government loans that probably helped seed that company as well as your own private investments. I mean, where does government have a place in all that?
Well, actually, it's a really good point because sometimes when I talk about government's interference in business, people think I'm anti-regulation, and I'm not. I like yellow stripes on highways. I like stop signs. You know, I like traffic lights when they're necessary. So it's not a matter of anti-regulation. It's a matter of hyper or over-regulation. It's the very tendency of business, of government. It's the very nature of government to expand and grow. And that's because a lot of people who get in government are service-oriented and service-minded, and they get in government because they want to solve problems. But sometimes in the process of solving a problem, government becomes the problem. Our company did begin out of a discovery made by the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences that a compound in scope mouth rinse was more effective at controlling salmonella on chicken. Of course, chicken's an important product here in Arkansas. And then Safe Foods was able to secure a line of credit, an $8 million line of credit because of a guarantee from the Arkansas Development and Finance Authority. You know, I think those are legitimate functions of state government, and I've never objected to them at all. And of course, I made those decisions because as a fiduciary for my company and my investors, I'm obligated to make the very best decisions I can for my company and my investors. As governor, you assume a different fiduciary role.
In a recent debate at the Faulkner County Tea Party, Coleman and Asa Hutchinson fielded questions on the private option. Coleman's against it. School vouchers, he's for them. And tax cuts, the raging debate in this year's gubernatorial race. Coleman's 10-year plan would ultimately shrink tax collections in Arkansas, or return to taxpayers, depending on your phrasing, $2.3 billion, roughly half of current total state revenues.
You talk about that whole balance there, though, of cutting taxes. You got to maintain some level of state revenue so that you can balance a budget and provide for the government services that Arkansans do need. Now, I've heard you say, too, that while I know you have some plans for education reform, yes, but you're not going to touch education spending in a way that's going to jeopardize maybe the Lakeview decision, for instance. But what would you cut in terms of cutting that expense?
Well, that's a good question. And the honest answer is I got to get inside and look a little harder to understand where we can. As a CEO, I know I could say to my company and all my department heads, I want you to cut overhead by 1% next year. And I believe we can do that in Arkansas without affecting any of the programs, any of the services, even any of the employees that we have in state government. I think we can do a 1% cut in the overhead cost of operating the agencies that report to the governor. Doing that, you just cut $50 million out of our operating budget. That's the first thing I want to do. Then give me a year, that first year. Let's cut $50 million just with a simple 1% reduction across the board. Then give me a year to dig in and take a real hard look at all the agencies that report to the governor. And I think, based on my discussions with people inside government today and some department heads inside government today, and I'm not going to disclose their names for their own sake, but I think we can achieve at least efficiencies that'll cut the cost of government by $300 to $400 million a year without reducing services to Arkansans.
Well, and the same criticisms that have been leveled at Asa Hutchinson and Mike Ross on their tax reform proposals, they're too vague and there's not a timeline for this. I mean, that same criticism could be applied to what you've just described to me. It's give me the keys to state government and I'll figure it out if you elect me.
Give me one.
I mean, you've been around state government enough. Give me one particular department or agency that you think, I know that there's something to be cut there.
Well, I'll tell you one place I would start and look very intensely would be Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality. I think we can make significant cuts in ADEQ. And I think we can do that in a way that enables Arkansas businesses to function more profitably with a lot less red tape. And I think we can reduce the overhead of ADEQ and at the same time let Arkansas businesses function with a little more freedom and liberty and therefore more profitability. That's one of the places I'd start looking. I'm also aware that all the agencies, let me be careful in characterizing all, but I know that it's a common practice to have placeholders in agencies for employees that are never hired and never filled, but there's a budget and there's expense there. Let's take a look at those. Let's take a look at those processes. And I think, you know, somebody said, where are you going to cut? And I think, frankly, we can probably cut everywhere. And that's my intent because I think that there are processes where there's an effort to protect budgets because in the current process we use is we take the budget from last year and try to get more money and build on it. Let's start with a business-like approach where we do performance-based budgeting. Let's do zero balance budgeting. And let's also do something where we start defining what success looks like for every agency in state government. Not all the agencies do that. Not all the agencies have a mission statement. It's like, you know, if you start out, if you don't know where you're going, you never know when you arrive. And I think if we start defining what the purpose of these agencies is, I think we're going to start finding things that we don't want to keep doing.
Coleman is traveling the state asking for votes, running to the right of his primary opponent. It begs the question of whether the older traditional Republican Party base and the relatively young Tea Party movement can coexist under the tent of the GOP.
If the Republicans, though, in terms of governing at the state legislature, even at the congressional level, if they continue to moderate, which seems to be where the schism occurs, people that are meeting in the middle versus people that are standing for a principle and not budging, not bending, is it ultimately something that can't be healed, something that can't be come together? Do you see the Republican Party always finding a way to coalesce after these really harsh kind of internal battles?
Yeah, I think the Republican Party is going to coalesce.
You don't think the Tea Party splits off at some point in time, becomes its own
movement? I'm not qualified to speak for the Tea Party, I will tell you, but no, but I don't
just
think
your
so.
Observation.
I think the Tea Party understands that their most effective course of action is to have more influence in the Republican Party. And I think that's where they're going to land and what they're going to do. They understand that. And these are intelligent people and intelligent political people. And I think they understand that the best opportunity for them to see their principles and ideologies prevail is going to be more influential inside the party.
That was Roby Brock speaking with gubernatorial candidate Curtis Coleman. The interview recently aired on Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock on KATV. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Still ahead on this edition of Ozarks, though the tinkering duo, American Native, started out with belts, using them as a starting point in their journey in working with leather. They would like to be known as much more than belt makers.
Because that's not really the whole passion. It's right. To do more bigger creative pieces that, you know. I mean, belts are awesome, I guess, but they seem kind of typical. They're often needed, but just kind of there, so...
And you've also, I think we've definitely developed even the most basic things like the belt. I've seen where I see our belt now versus, you know, a year and a half ago, I've definitely seen some quality progression and that kind of thing. So I think even in our most basic items that we haven't necessarily moved on from them, we've made them better, but it's just not as much where the passion is lying anymore.
A visit to the garage workshop of American Native to see what else they've been working on in about 15 minutes here on Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Only 5% of the students who applied to Stanford this year got in. That figure is less than half of what it was 10 years ago, and the story is the same at colleges and universities across the country. So what gives students who are accepted an edge? We'll ask a college counselor next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
That's coming up in the first hour of Here and Now, just ahead at 1 o'clock here on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. If you are going to sponsor a series of lectures with the words Distinguished Readers in the title, it's hard to imagine a more worthy guest speaker than Joyce Carol Oates. She will be in Fayetteville Monday night as the featured reader in such a series sponsored by the University of Arkansas's Creative Writing and Translation Department. Oates certainly is distinguished. Since 1963, she's had 40 books on the New York Times bestseller list. She earned the National Book Award in 1970, has been awarded the O. Henry Prize, and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Book Critics Circle. She's written fiction, nonfiction, poetry, essays, and is a prolific book reviewer and literary critic. She also teaches. She's a professor at Princeton. Last month, I talked to Ms. Oates in anticipation of her appearance in Fayetteville. She says of all her endeavors, the ones most closely linked are teaching and her public readings.
It probably relates to teaching, because when you're teaching, you're obviously speaking in public and meeting people and discussing literature and ideas and so forth. So I think being a writer is a very, obviously very solitary and can be somewhat lonely occupation. I always thought I would be a teacher already when I was in first or second grade. So that's been very natural to me to go out and give readings and meet people.
Joyce Carol Oates says her teaching is invested in the analyzation of writing. For her classes, including a graduate seminar she's teaching this spring at NYU, she assigns her students great works like the short stories of Ernest Hemingway or the poems of William Carlos Williams.
Works of fiction that are helpful to me, to the instructor, you know, to look at the craft, for instance. The very elegant craft that goes into a Hemingway short story is very helpful for a writer to be always reading in that way. You know, not so much just reading for enjoyment or entertainment, but reading to see how it's put together. So the teaching that I've done has always dealt with fiction analysis.
She takes a similar approach to her own writing, analysis and more analysis. She says she reads sentences aloud as if they're poetry. She studies word choices and paragraphing and the structure of things that are not discussed or even thought about usually outside of a classroom. And she reads all the time. She describes her reading as wide and indiscriminate.
I get lots of new galleys. I have bound galleys on my desk here. I might just, instead of doing my own work, I might just sit and read a story or a novella or something, you know, just sort of spontaneously or, you know, without any purpose to it, except enjoying it. Then I often reread. But since I have so much work that I'm doing, I've assigned two long stories for my students for this week, so I'll be rereading them. One by H.P. Lovecraft and one by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, so I'll be reading that. That I often am reviewing.
You can gain some insight into how the writer works by searching out an interview Joyce Carol Oates did with the Washington Post last September. She was interviewed by herself. In that piece, she pointedly asks herself questions about writing and discusses the anxiety she says is associated with writing. In fact, she says the more anxiety she feels, the more she knows she's headed in the right direction.
Well, yes, I think so. I'm working on something now that is very frustrating, so I keep trying to get into it. You know, I'm on page 2. I've written many, many, many pages, but I keep going back and I keep chiseling away. It's as if there is a big, very large block of granite, and something shapely is inside it, and I'm just sort of chiseling away, and I think that is the opposite of feeling that you've gotten it right the first time. It's sort of a feeling that you have to keep trying. So you feel stressful and frustrated. Now, I think it may be the case that people who are serious writers and artists are the ones who are not satisfied with what comes out first and keep trying and see if you can make it better, come back to it, try again. And I'm just guessing. There may be great artists like Mozart who just get it perfectly the first time. But many composers like Beethoven, even Chopin, they had ideas, but then they had to work with them. So there are all kinds of emotions. There's sort of self-disgust and dismay. And then I go out for a walk or go running, and I get some new ideas. So I come back and I try it again. So there's a little feeling of excitement, you know, of a new way to tell the story.
She says she may read from that Washington Post self-interview when she's at the town center Monday night. Expect some amount of analysis of what writing is and what it can mean. She seems to be constantly evaluating the act. And she writes apparently nonstop. She's averaged 2 published books a year during her professional career. During our conversation, she talked about a project she's currently working on that's been with her for years.
So at the moment, I'm writing a memoir piece about a girl I went to high school with who committed suicide her freshman year in college. And I always wanted to write about her. She was a friend, and I wanted to talk about, you know, issues of suicide and all that. And I was sort of trying to deal with this and having a really difficult time, because when I knew her, of course we didn't know she was going to commit suicide. And so it's falsifying to write about her as I knew her in high school with this sort of secondary knowledge, if you follow my meaning. Well, the problem, I think, with the retrospective vision in a memoir is that you know too much. You know how someone is going to turn out, somebody dies young. When you lived and knew that person, you had no knowledge of the future.
Right.
So how do you evoke the past in an honest way when you already know the ending of something? I'm finding that extremely challenging.
Joyce Carol Oates will be at the Fayetteville Town Center at 7 p.m. Monday night. The event is free and is open to the public and is part of the University of Arkansas's Creative Writing and Translation Program's Distinguished Lecture Series. She talked with me from her home last month. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Walton Art Center presents the Improvised Shakespeare Company April 23rd as part of the 10x10 Art Series. This company uses audience suggestions to improvise an entire play using the language and themes of Shakespeare's Elizabethan works. Tickets and information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600.
KUAF is supported by Penguin Ed's Barbecue, offering catering services for parties or events of any size, either at your location or one of the banquet rooms at the Mission and Weddington restaurants. Various catering packages are available. PenguinEds.com for more information.
Still ahead on this edition of Ozarks, I talk with a historian who says the indigenous people of Mexico were strong negotiators who looked out for themselves, contrary to what some believe.
But first, there are just a couple of performances you might want to catch this evening. University Programs will host author and comedian Rob Delaney tonight at 8 p.m. in the Verizon Ballroom at the Arkansas Union. This event is free to current University of Arkansas Fayetteville students who pay the student activities fee. Students must show ID for entrance. Admission for general public and non-fee paying students is contingent upon seating availability and will be on a first-come, first-served basis after fee-paying students are admitted. For special accommodations due to disability, please contact the Office of Student Activities at osa@uark.edu.
Rob Delaney, by the way, in 2012, named the funniest person on Twitter by Comedy Central.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll have to check him out.
Okay. He's got like 1.7 million followers or something. Also tonight, the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Symphonic Band will present an evening of classic symphonic works in a concert that will highlight new music composers from the 20th and 21st centuries. It begins at 7:30 at the Arkansas Best Corporation Performing Arts Center at the Fort Smith Convention Center, and this is part of the UAFS Season of Entertainment 33. Therefore, admission by Season 33 season ticket, or you can buy an individual ticket, which costs $6. Tickets are available online at uafs.edu. You can also call the UAFS box office at 788-7300.
This is Ozarks at Large.
The Fort Smith Chorale presented their concert of Love and War April 10th at the First Baptist Church in Fort Smith. Hi, I'm Katie Hendrickson, host of Up Note Monday through Friday from 11 to noon right here on KUAF. Join me Friday for that concert. That's coming up 11 to noon Friday right here on your source for classical music, KUAF.
Every year, the Dogwood Festival takes place in Siloam Springs during the weekend of the last Sunday in April and brings an estimated 30,000 people to the downtown area. This year, a new festival that coincides with the Dogwood Festival is looking to draw some attention from that large crowd. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The 40th annual Dogwood Festival is scheduled for April 25th through the 27th in Siloam Springs. A new event taking place April 26th is looking to attract the attention of folks attending the well-established festival. The inaugural Homegrown Festival will showcase handmade goods and food from around the region. Matt Feierabend is one of the festival's organizers. He says the idea came from a random mix of people who care about Siloam Springs and want to see new and exciting things happening in their town. While they would like the festival to be its own event in the future, Matt says they thought it would be nice to piggyback on a festival that already exists. The Dogwood Festival is organized by the Siloam Springs Chamber of Commerce's Volunteer Dogwood Festival Committee. Matt says his group met with the committee and was pleased with the results.
We said, hey, here's our idea. We want to kind of focus on local vendors, local creators, and local curators. And we said, that's not a big part of your identity right now. Are you guys open to us doing something on the same weekend? And we were actually really pleasantly surprised that they were all on board. They were like, yes, that's the direction we want to take our festival eventually. We want to have more local vendors, but it's going to be, you know, several years before they can be primarily focused on that. And so they said, we would welcome you guys coming in and doing it on the same weekend as us.
Matt says the long-term goal is to have the Homegrown Festival be a separate event, likely in the fall, that helps bring people back to Siloam Springs. Next weekend's inaugural festival will include a number of local vendors, including Noble Dwelling, Pure Joy Ice Cream, Rascal and Betty, and American Native.
I think it was just after the Dogwood Festival last year when we started talking about, hey, what would we want to see in a festival if we were going to do our own? One of the vendors that came up immediately was American Native. We said, we know those guys. They both graduated from John Brown University, which is right here in Siloam Springs. And we said, those guys are doing the kinds of things we're talking about. It's handmade leather goods. Some of them are made out of denim, but primarily leather, leather goods, belts, things like that. And they're doing high quality. They're doing really unique, really contemporary style stuff, too.
American Native is run by brothers Bobby and Clayton Chamberlain. The two work out of the garage of Bobby's multi-level home, which is located on the east side of Fayetteville.
It's a little rickety, and watch your head.
After descending some stairs into the garage, you'll notice a large table located on the opposite side of the room. Sitting atop it are various tools like a sewing machine and a green cutting board. An American Native sign hangs on the east wall. Belts and an apron hang from one shelving unit, and an American flag is draped on another. Bobby and Clayton were raised on a farm in Jay, Oklahoma, and both graduated from John Brown University with a degree in graphic design. The name American Native comes from the fact that the brothers have some Cherokee ancestry and that their items are made in the United States. The brothers grew up in rural Oklahoma with a father who was quite handy. Bobby calls finding a way to make something work yourself instead of buying something new, maker's spirit. Clayton recalls using his hands a lot as a child.
For me, I think I struggled more with just sitting down and being on a computer all day. Because even though growing up on a farm, I wasn't sewing or anything, obviously. I had more hands-on work and was involved with just, you know, piddling around and doing stuff on, you know, there's not many.
You're a tinker.
Tinker, yeah. with not a lot of other children around growing up, you'd do things amongst the family and just find things to keep you entertained on a farm. So I think I've always enjoyed working with my hands, and I think that's where after graduating, I was like, well, I kind of want to do something with my hands. And then just from everything else that stemmed out, like,
I think it's a way to sort of marry the creativity with still some manual labor and that kind of thing. Still, like, you're not just someone who mass produces a lot of something. You're not just on an assembly line or anything like that. You're someone who has control over what the item looks like. Yeah. You can influence it. You can change things about it.
During the fall of 2011, a road trip through the South included stops at some small mom-and-pop shops. The Chamberlain brothers were inspired to create a jean company, so they enrolled in sewing lessons. After that, they started discussing things they could make more easily. Bobby and Clayton noticed a trend of people being more detail-oriented and creating handmade goods, and they wanted to be part of that. In early 2012, they opened up an Etsy store and sold items like belts and keychains. While they still make leather belts, Clayton says they do so much more.
Friends and relatives, and people just kind of, when we started doing things, were like, oh yeah, well, you guys are belt makers. I'm like, well, belts are where we're starting. Belts are a learning, kind of a good transition to learn from leather, because you learn kind of how it works, how to cut it, what to do with it. And then, I mean, it's kind of the simplest thing to do, because you're cutting straps out of a side of leather, and then you learn how to finish. But I was like, I don't really want to be pegged as just a belt maker, because that's not really the whole passion. It's right. To do more bigger creative pieces that, you know, I mean, belts are awesome, I guess, but they seem kind of typical. They're often needed, but just kind of there. So,
and you've also, I think we've definitely developed even the most basic things like the belt. I've seen where I see our belt now versus, you know, a year and a half ago, I've definitely seen some quality progression and that kind of thing. So I think even in our most basic items that we've kind of we haven't necessarily moved on from them. We've made them better, but it's just not as much where the passion is lying anymore.
Today, they also make other items like waxed canvas bags, as well as selvedge denim and leather aprons. Some of their goods are sold at Four-Legged Bird in Fayetteville, and Bobby says while they want to have some brick-and-mortar presence, their main focus is online sales. Through these sales, the Chamberlain brothers have been able to ship their goods internationally to places like Canada, Australia, and Singapore. The internet has also provided them with help when it comes to working with different materials like leather. They've also learned quite a bit just from hands-on experience.
Leather's not very forgiving in a lot of ways. You get a speck of something on a natural belt, you ruin the leather. Unless you dye it, then maybe that works. But especially in the sewing and that kind of thing, Leather is not forgiving at all. Once the needle has poked a hole in it, it's not like fabric. You take it out and it leaves permanent holes in it. So it's something to figure out and to get right. There has been a learning curve for sure.
Yeah, there has. Just from, we have like a heavier sewing machine that will handle. My brother's a little terrified of it. But just figuring out like the different needle sizes you need for sewing, you know, a thicker leather. It's just there's definitely been times where you're just basically Googling and on like leather worker forums where like 60-year-old and retirees are talking about leather and what they do, and you're like, oh yeah, this is great, because they're just imparting wisdom on me and they don't even know it. And I can just, you know, well, it takes some researching to find those threads, but then you can find out what other people are doing and what size of needle goes with what size thread, and it's definitely been a challenge.
The more we experiment, the better we get at it.
Bobby says sometimes it feels like they are always experimenting. He says they're on this journey of figuring out what the right thing is, but that keeps it interesting and it keeps them engaged. The Chamberlain brothers are currently working on a leather wallet they hope to start selling soon. Bobby says there's a growing audience that cares about the origins of the products they buy and are willing to pay a little more for a quality product that will last longer. He says it's an honor to be part of a trend of creating quality handmade items. While it hasn't been easy, Bobby has a positive outlook on the company's future.
It's been work. It's not always the most, sometimes thankless, but at the same time, it's really exciting to see other people get excited about the things that, you know, we're usually pretty excited about, but sometimes we're just like, you know what, it was frustrating this time and this product. We're trying to figure out this. We're trying to nail down that. But we're optimistic about the future and want to start kind of promoting ourselves better, growing our audience, refining our products, maybe taking away a few, adding a few. I see that as far as kind of back to the fad comment, I think like I see that as we have some sort of small company, we're agile enough that we can kind of work with what the demand is, and we're willing to kind of change our products a bit while just really maintaining that quality to fit what the interest is.
American Native is one of several vendors participating in the inaugural Homegrown Festival, which is scheduled from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. April 26th on Broadway Street in Siloam Springs. For event details, visit facebook.com/homegrownfestar. For more on the Chamberlain brothers, visit americannativegoods.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It is Thursday, April 17th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, as Trout Fishing in America would say, everybody needs to get their little bunny foo-foo ears up. Okay,
it's almost Easter. The Easter rabbit?
We're going to talk about the Easter rabbit. Nobody here is putting their little bunny foo-foo ears up. So
there you go.
I sincerely hope that you are. The Easter bunny, of course, is at the Northwest Arkansas Mall for photos, because it's coming up on Easter. Mm-hmm. But there are other things going on, too. The 21st annual Eminent Augustine Foundation's Easter Feed is Saturday.
Yes, it is. Big, great event.
Easter Feed?
Feed,
okay. 6,000 meals will be served at Central United Methodist Church in Fayetteville from 11 to 2. It is free to anyone who wants to come and eat.
It's a wonderful event.
It is also the Oakley Chapel's Easter celebration from 1 to 3 on Saturday. Mm-hmm. And that happens at 203 South Promenade Boulevard in Rogers. There's an Easter egg hunt and carnival sponsored by the Bella Vista Property Owners Association. 15,000 hidden eggs and the Easter bunny laying those little darlings as fast as he can. It happens from 10 to noon on Saturday at Reardon Hall. Tickets are required by calling 855-5073.
15,000?
Yes.
Wow, that's a lot of eggs.
You should be the bunny.
Yeah, exactly. All right, thank you, Becca.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. Mexico's history over the past five centuries is rich, and according to Dr. Ethelia Ruiz Medrano, misunderstood, both in Mexico and outside of the country. She's written 11 books about her native country, examining the legacy of Mexico's indigenous people and the complicated relationships with European newcomers. She spent a dozen years researching her latest book, Indigenous Manuscripts, Paintings, and Politics in Mexico, Colonial and National Records. In the book, she uses historical documents, art, and other artifacts to offer a reconstructed view of the confrontations between indigenous people and Spanish colonial authorities beginning in the 16th century. Dr. Medrano spoke on the University of Arkansas campus last night as the guest of the U of A's Latin American and Latino Studies program. Before her address, she came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. She says she was inspired to write her latest book because the plight of Mexico's indigenous people is generally relegated into one of two tropes: people victimized by events outside of their control, or savages conquered by Europeans. Rather, she argues, the historical records show there were negotiations and agreements written by the Indians themselves to defend their lands.
What was most difficult of it is that most specialists, especially in Latin America, well, especially in Mexico, and also colleagues from other places, other countries, always understand indigenous communities as a trap in a very sad destiny, in a very destructive destiny, and everything is lost, and they are like, if they were in Noah's Ark, you know, fighting in the waves, and it's their victims, they will not survive. And, you know, this idea of being victims and knowing that I have indigenous blood, I started to think if we are a country of victims, then we deserve what happens to us. But how about if we have tried and if we had fought? And it was just the context, the things that happened, but that we try to negotiate. We try to go out. I mean, we try to get it back to what belonged to us. And so my ancestors. And as soon as I started thinking about that and reading the literature of the subject, I saw that there were two ideas about this. One that was that this poor indigenous people, they are like sheep. You know, they're so little, so small, so beautiful. It's so terrible that they kill them all. And then I thought, okay, and what is more than 100 million Mexicans doing over here if we got killed? So it didn't happen. And on the other side is that, now, these were savages. They were always making war. I mean, they couldn't stop killing each other. I mean, they deserve what happened. I mean, they just wanted to eat the Spaniards for breakfast or lunch. I mean, we can't have those kind of people around. Then I said, no, there must be a middle thing that has to do with constructing civilization, that has to do with something, as Levi-Strauss found out, about indigenous religions in the Amazonian, that not all is material, that what is in the head of the people has to do with creating civilization, because it's a complex mind, it's a complex religion, it's a complex way of negotiating things, even if the doors are closed. And that's what indigenous people do and have done. It doesn't mean that they didn't defend themselves. They were warriors. I mean, they did defend, and they were defeated. But the stories that I care for is the story of trying to struggle for a negotiation to open doors, not to give up, try to have, you know, think of their descendants and of their future. And in that sense, is a success story. And for that, you have to go 500 years and you have to use a lot of sources, not only painted sources, but also written sources in indigenous language. And you have to do field work. Because to say, oh, you know, globalization is awful, and, well, that's neoliberalism. Oh, sorry for those poor things. Yeah, I just have to say it, you know? That's easy. But to prove the other thing, you really need to work a lot because nobody will believe it that easily.
You mentioned that to tell this historical story of that not savages, not victims, but people who negotiated and looked out for themselves, that you had many different sources. Sources that span centuries. So what kind of, just give me an example of a couple of sources that you would be able to find.
Well, we have like more than 5,000 litigation suits files in the Archive of Mexico. And then you have the most important archives in Latin America and Mexico. Small towns can have like a room full of papers. And then you have specialized archives for this and that. And then we have the Imperial Archive. That is the Archive of Indias. Because Spain generated, well, Castilla generated in 16th century the most powerful bureaucracy machine in the world. It was a giant. And so we have thousands of sources there that had to do with indigenous people sending letters in Nahuatl or in other indigenous languages, and then themselves translated to Spanish or Latin so that the Council of Indias, which was in charge by the Spanish ruler of all the matters of their colonies in what is now Latin America, except Brazil, will read it and then do a resume and tell the king, okay, the lords are asking for this and this and this. So there are thousands and thousands of things, and then of papers. And then I have to cross many of this with, pictographical native paintings. I don't know how you say that. I had the word codices, a codex. Native paintings that were used for trials. They were like what you say, uses and costumes that were accepted by Spanish courts, which mean their languages, all their languages. They had translators for that. And their paintings. The paintings, the codices, were not only made for religious purposes or for counting purposes. They were also made to tell the stories in drawings, in hieroglyphics, in glyphics, of what was going on. This is our land. This is a person who wants to take it. And there were thousands of those. I mean, more than thousands. And we still have hundreds of them all over Mexico. And, I mean, we have them even in collections like France with the trial attached in written in Spanish.
Is there a sense among the communities that are heavily populated by indigenous people of that local history? Is that story, that narrative known?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have recuperated a lot. I mean, it has changed, of course. It's very dynamical, like all orality. Mm-hmm. And it has a purpose. I mean, it's not that, like, you sit down and with the people or the authorities and or the old people and say, well, here's a tape recorder, just go and hit it, you know. Let's start from the beginning. It's history is also has to do with, Frank Solomon says, who is a great specialist in Peru, it involves our five senses, smell, sight, our hearing of music. So history has to do also for them as a complex narrative where smells are important, like different kind of foods for the festivals that bring the memory back, and also sometimes alcohol, some kind of special alcohol. And then their senses, the feeling of the leaves where they arrange everything for the feasts, and also the things smells make you go back, and the music and the dancing is a very complex narrative. And they have a lot of material like codices, pyramids, and they know exactly. So maybe sometimes it happens that they won't tell you like, oh yes, this is a codice, interesting, these rulers are this and that, and you show them a codex, 500-year-old, only the photocopies because it's out of their town since 19th century. It's not like that. But there will always be an old person who will say, oh yes, yes. My grandmother told me about the kings, and you see the codice, and you know that is a genealogical codice. How does that lady know? She's 90. So many things I have recuperated, and they can go very far away, back. And if you know history, if you know the sources, you can connect them. But yes, they can go deep.
How did you know you were done? If you spent 12 years doing this, how did you know when it was time to?
Well, it's just that I thought, if I keep, searching, I will always have something to add, and I will never finish. And I really want to say, I have to do it. It will have a lot of mistakes. Only God is perfect. So, it's better to just throw it to the world and see if somebody, takes the message in the bottle and reads it and say, oh, okay, interesting. And that's it. So I just said, yeah, it's enough. I mean, every time I say it, I won't find another cut. They say, oh, in that little village they have one. Okay, no, not anymore. No, please, God help me. No, please, I have to finish this. So I just said that. I mean, I'm not perfect. I'm just trying to be optimistic with my work. And if I wanted other people to read it and see this, I just have to publish it or try to publish it. And so I said, well, okay, goodbye. And now I'm working on another project.
And now another one. Yes. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Dr. Athalia Ruiz Medrano is the author of 11 books, including her latest, Indigenous Manuscripts, Paintings, and Politics in Mexico, Colonial and National Records. She is a professor at the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico, and she was on the University of Arkansas campus yesterday as the guest of the U of A's Latin American and Latino Studies program and the Department of Art. This is Ozarks at Large.
This week, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me tries to actually be good for you. We study history with Doris Kearns Goodwin, classical music with Emmanuel Ax, and politics with Senator Jeff Flake. I'm Peter Sagal. Now that Oprah's off the air, somebody's got to help you people with this stuff. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Saturday morning at 9 here on KUAF.
The 2014 Fayetteville Roots Festival is coming in August, but you could win tickets now. The KUAF website giveaway is offering one winner a chance to win two sold-out VIP passes to see Lucinda Williams, the Wood Brothers, and more. The winner will be announced on Friday, April 25th, a week from tomorrow, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration available at KUAF.com.
The annual Champion for Kids Razor Fest is Saturday, April 26th at the Razorback Stadium in Fayetteville. This free family event begins at 10 a.m. and features games, autographs, live music, and giveaways. The U of A red and white football game begins at 1 p.m. More information available at championsforkids.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Paris.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
You'll be back tomorrow with Antoinette Grajeda?
That's right, at noon for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. We'll be here Sunday morning.
We will, for an Easter edition.
That's right.
Thanks for listening.